Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Attentie, attentie, which is of course Dutch and indeed Flemish for Achtung, Achtung. Correct me on the pronunciation, please. Expect R.G. Pullison will be in to straighten me out there. It seems only appropriate to use the language of the Low Countries in the week that marks the 80th anniversary of the time those same countries were brought to their lowest ebb by the invading German troops. In fact, Sunday was the anniversary of the British Expeditionary Force Commander General Lord Gort ordering his troops to fall back to the Scheldt River. Now, if only we had one of those, you know, bookish, knowledgeable historians to hand, one of those chaps who knows what this all means. But wait, who do I see emerging from the Wiltshire mist in battle dress and flying goggles via the miracle of the internet? That's right. It's none other than James Holland, author of such well-known tomes as War in the West, Volumes 1 and 2. But not as yet, no spoilers, but Volume 3 isn't not yet complete, is it, James?
It's not
what
yet.
What happens at the end?
I was going to do it this year, but the trouble is I'm not going to be able to get to half the archives I need to get to. I can't plan on it. So it makes it all a bit difficult. Yeah. And obviously, you can't cut any corners with War in the West 3. So, yeah, it's just on hold. It'll be done for 2022, I reckon.
Yeah, yeah. A couple of things have caught our eye.
Yes.
One of the things I wanted to talk about was this Lord Ashcroft. We'll get to the other thing in a minute, because we do need to talk about both these things. Lord Ashcroft has tweeted today.
Yeah.
It's a sort of classic of the genre. And I personally think he should know better, because he knows his stuff. But he tweeted, perhaps if World War II happened, the questions would include, can I have more clarity in the your country needs you slogan? It's too ambiguous. Well, that's the First World War, my lad. First of all, why aren't you doing enough to prevent these air raids? That is that there was a raging daily debate about that. And you had the contrast between what central government was trying to do, what local government was trying to do or had tried to do and had failed to do in some instances, the lack of provision that was completely locally based, and plenty of grumbling and griping
also,
about air raids.
And also lots of people and they were ordered to fire all their guns all the time to make it sound like there were more anti-aircraft guns than there really were.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Because they hadn't got enough.
Why does the siren apply to everyone? Well, it did, but people chose to do what they wanted. So some people didn't go into air raid shelter. So that's that. There are only male and female toilets in the air raid shelter, and I don't identify as either. Ah, come on, anachronism, back off. Right, this respirator haversack has a leather strap, and I'm a vegan. Again, that's foolish anachronism
rubbish,
of the worst.
It's just silly.
Yeah, why can't I have almond milk on my ration card? Well, almond milk, because it hasn't been invented yet,
then.
You muppet. I find the term blackout offensive. Ah, God. I find the lack of colour options within military uniforms oppressive. Yes, which is why, of course, everyone customised their uniforms. Yes, and vegetarians had their own ration cards, I am informed by one of our... if it was QI, we'd call him an elf, but this isn't... They're not elves on this show. They're troopers.
Yeah.
Troopers, information troopers deep within our...
Trooper McCarthy.
Information frontline. I mean, everyone used to customise uniforms. This was the thing. I mean, this is the thing that time immemorial is that British, especially officers, have customised their uniforms and done what they want with them. And in the end, you know, Montgomery had one rule about uniforms in 8th Army, which was no top hats, famously.
Yes.
He saw a man with a top hat.
And my great hero, Field Marshal Alexander, he had his own hatter develop his peat caps on the Russia, a little bit like the Russian model, because he thought they'd cut a dash.
And then finally, why didn't we have stockpiles of Spitfires at the start of this conflict? We did! That's the point! How else did we win the Battle of Britain? And I mean, it's just, honestly. And the thing is, I mean, you know, we will next week, I think, be talking to David Edgerton, who makes basically this exact point. He says Spitfires, the provision for Spitfires was laid down in 1935. So it's not like Britain enters the war in 1939 with her trousers down. He should know better.
He's a great collector. He's obviously been a big supporter of the Bomber Command Memorial and all the rest of it. You know, he's donated a lot to the Imperial War Museum. He's done lots of great works.
Yeah.
But I've met him a few times, and he's perfectly civil and everything. And I did a TV show with him once.
Yeah.
But I didn't get the impression there was a huge amount of knowledge there. I'm not going to lie.
The thing is, he's being provocative. And if you want to get, I mean, if you a large chunk of people who were complaining about the war in itself in 39-40 were Conservative MPs.
It's and, very
you know,
true.
And the Conservative top brass who'd backed appeasement. Halifax in particular, who's the equivalent of Halifax? If we're going to compare to the Second World War, who's the equivalent of Halifax? The Tories saying, the politicians right now going, lockdown's not worth it. Quit lockdown. We've all overreacted. This isn't the threat that everyone says it is. Let's throw the towel in on this one. Who's Lord Halifax right now? And if he insists on that conversation, then I insist on asking him, is he Lord Halifax or not? Anyway,
that's hilarious.
But something that, I mean, this is just me feeling itchy because of one tweet. There's something that's got your dander up, isn't it, James?
Well, also because about eight people have sent it to me. What do you think of this then, James? Eh? Okay, so this has annoyed me on two levels. Happened is Anthony Beaver has had his book on Arnhem finally published in the US because the USC, yeah. I presumably see Market Garden as a predominantly American, British effort, obviously forgetting the crucial role played by one particular general in their airborne division.
The independent company know who we're talking about.
We know who we're talking about. So anyway, for whatever reason, it's finally coming out in the US. And Anthony's good friend, Max Hastings, and they're very, very good, old mates. They're competitive with one another, but they're old friends. Has written a review for the New York Times, which in itself is really, really not on. Because whenever I've written reviews for the New York Times, review of books, which I have to say has only been about twice, I've had to sign away my life and say that I haven't any connection with anybody. I don't know these people. I've got nothing that would bias or influence my review, blah, 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 blah. And actually, the same for the Wall Street Journal. And actually, the Wall Street Journal recently asked me to review Max's book on the dams raid. And I said to them, I will do so, but I just want you to know that I do know Max. I mean, I don't know him very well, but I do know him. And they went, will that influence your review? And I went, nope. And they went, okay, fine. But there are checks. So the idea that Max is writing a balanced and objective view of Anthony's book is really... and it shouldn't be a back-scratching exercise. And it is. And you see this time and time again in reviews, in books, in newspapers, of books in newspapers.
Private Eye always very hot on this at Christmas, aren't they? Where they do the thing where everyone recommends each other's books.
Yeah, it's just nauseating.
And they lay it out
it's
where everyone
nauseating.
Just recommends each other's
I
books.
I just can't bear it. But anyway... So that in itself is a bit naughty, but it's kind of fine. But the big thing is that Max completely slags off the British soldier of World War II and just says, this is it. Yeah. It proves it once and for all that the British were crap and the Germans are really good.
Well, let me read the first two sentences, because actually I got sent it. What do you think about this? And I read the first two sentences, and then I put it down on Sunday to not. I thought I'm not going to read this because it's just gonna
annoy you too.
And then ten minutes before we set this Zoom up, I'm going to have to read it, aren't I? They were better. First sentence: they were better. Second sentence: man for man, German soldiers fought more effectively in World War II than their Allied counterparts did. Right. And then it goes on to, you know, and this is illustrated no more clearly than at Arnhem. Now, I'm plugging next Thursday, not this Thursday, because that's Philippe Sands again, but the Thursday after's podcast with David Edgerton, we talk about Britain's war machine with him. And he says, the problem is what you have here is an explanation for something, and it's explaining something that didn't happen. The explanation that's taken on life is explaining something that isn't what occurred. So you've got two things wrong in the... And I've always felt... And I remember when I went to the Borgibu Ridge, the first time I went there when I was an adult, not with my dad, when we got lost around there in the car and he bawled me out for bad map reading. we got to the top of the Borgibu Ridge and I was interviewing a guy from a... tank regiment, and he said, and we didn't use it in the program because my producer said, oh God, we can't use it. He goes, oh, the likes of Max Hastings says we were useless soldiers. In that case, how did we get to the top of this fucking ridge? Like, well, they were better than us, but we still got up here. And he goes, you look at it, look all the way down there. They can see us coming miles off. You're like, yeah. And he's like, yeah, it's amazing. How, you know, and it's just this thing
Also, the other problem is what he's saying is man for man. He's not saying organisation for organisation. He's saying man for man. And that is just simply bollocks, because it depends.
Yeah.
Which man, which unit, when, where, what stage of the war, a whole host of factors. But if you're going man for man as an average, as a mean over the whole nearly six years of war, I just think that's absolute nonsense. Utter nonsense.
Yeah.
I mean, you also got to accept, and this is not kind of, I'm really not trying to sound jingoistic here, but no army in the Second World War makes more ground for a loss of fewer lives than the British Army.
That's surely your metric, yeah.
Well, it's a pretty good metric, isn't it? And if that is your metric, then that makes that man for man, the British Army are considerably better than the Germans, whose war dead is around 9 million. You know, and it's just an absolute nonsense. And the idea that, and don't forget, this is a book about Arnhem. So the idea that the British paratroopers at Arnhem are worse man for man than the Germans they're coming up against at Arnhem is just absolute nonsense.
Well, because after all, they're being airborne soldiers. It's asymmetric. So you've got armoured vehicles against blokes who can't deploy armour, and they last 9 days.
But it's also the wrong metric, because it shouldn't. It's not man for man. It's army against army with all that goes with it, all that long tail, and yes, dare I say it, the operational level. I mean, it really is all that stuff. You know, it is. It's that big picture stuff. That is what is missing from the narrative of those books. And I've said it before, but let's just stress it again. What they do is they focus incredibly heavily on the strategic level and the tactical level, and their sympathies, and particularly Max's, lies very firmly with the poor bastards that have to do the fighting at the bottom, or the civilians who are being caught up in this maelstrom. And there is a real visceral anger from him at the commanders and the fact that so many people lost their lives. But that being so, then he should be praising the British, because they're far more careful of people's lives than everybody else's. I mean, not Arthur Harris, perhaps. But why is Arthur Harris doing what they're doing? They're doing it to limit the number of lives lost of your own side. And the job of your war leaders is to win the war as comprehensively and quickly as you possibly can for the fewest amount of deaths and casualties of your own people. And the British do that pretty efficiently. And actually, the Americans do it pretty efficiently as well, although the Americans are more gung-ho, not as careful with men's lives as the British are, all tied up with the fact that they haven't lost an entire generation in the First World War. There's exceptions to that, like Patton, who's a sort of, you know, he's a bit vainglorious. And it's really interesting. I think the Third Army has the highest casualties of any Allied army in the Second World War. And it's commanded by Patton. But, you know, it's all tied up with this whole idea of sort of, you know, British sort of stopping for tea and sort of, sorry, old chap, can't do it tonight, you know, because we've run out of daylight or you know, because I haven't had tiffin yet and all this kind of nonsense. Yeah. But there is a reason why we constantly reorganise our line when we come up to... Because what happens is, because we've worked out that the Germans always counterattack, if you can't bulldoze your way through immediately, what you then do is wait for the weight of your force to come up, reorganise, and then redeploy. That is a very, very sensible way of doing things. And of course, it does take a little bit more time on occasion. But that is also because you've got the problems of trying to moving all that mechanisation. But it is mainly because fighting an organised, well-prepared, properly deployed battle basically means you're then deploying your firepower. And it is the firepower that attrits and grinds down the Germans and makes sure you win. And obviously, what you don't want to do, and this is a really strict policy of the British, is once you've taken ground, you don't lose it. And the last time we do that is in North Africa. And that is the point when they go back to the Alamein line and Alexander takes over as commander-in-chief of the Middle East and Monty comes over as 8th Army and they go, there will be no more reverses. And that is it. And they, yeah. and they the only other time where they lose ground, and they do so deliberately, of course, is with Slim and 14th Army around Imphal. But otherwise, and that is a quite deliberate policy to grind down the Japanese 15th Army. But otherwise, the policy is to take land, hold on to it, not take it, and then lose 20 kilometres.
And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, this is just the first two sentences of this review, right? This is our review of the first two sentences of this review. Basically, we haven't got into the.
I have spent the whole morning with my fingers hovering over the two column on my inbox, saying to hovering about whether I email Max and go, "Whoa, mate, that was."
And after all, the famous thing about the tanks are stopping for tea, and Major Julian Cook saying, "Oh, there wasn't enough aggression," and then Dick Winter saying they weren't aggressive, and by the time Lord Carrington, the yet to be Lord Carrington, gets across Nijmegen Bridge, days later than he ought to have done for various reason, he's just got four tanks, so he can't. He hasn't got his FOOs. He hasn't got...
He hasn't got infantry.
He hasn't got coordinated infantry support. He's got American infantry support in the form of the 101st, but not the people he should be moving forward and all that. And what they're not, and like you say, that and the lights failing and tanks at night is a bad thing against the Germans, who are very expert at infiltrating against tanks. So, Anyway, that's the first two sentences of that review. We'll do the next two sentences in our following podcast. Right, we have them.
It's really, really got my goat. I've been feeling irritated by it all morning, I've got to say. It's really, really, really annoyed me.
Excellent. Right,
he's a nice chap, though, Max. I'll give him that. He's a really nice
guy. The thing is, I don't doubt it. And I've always, it's just, Normandy, his book about Normandy, I remember reading that in a pair with Carlo d'Este. And you just think this doesn't explain anything.
But it's also going back to all the shit. Have you read the Slam Marshall stuff that was written just after the war, where he worked out? I mean, the whole thing that they're kind of sort of that Germany is worth four times one. This was done by completely bogus analysis of bogus statistics, and has in academic circles is just kicked into touch such a long time ago. It's absolutely old news, and yet it's the stuff that on which. A lot of people have written their books, Carlo d'Este and Max, being but two.
Well, anyway, lots of correspondence from you in recent weeks. It's almost as if half the nation were trapped at home twiddling their thumbs, watching war movies or listening to Second World War podcasts. We've got a very interesting question from Colin Houston, one of our members of the Independent Company over on our Patreon. Colin asked, was the San Azair raid effective or a waste of lives? Well, this is open to massive debate. But what we did think would be interesting was to ask some people who know a lot about the subject. And, we're very fortunate. We have one of the descendants of the man who led the raid.
Got a VC.
And like one of those Victoria Crosses where it said, not only for your bravery, but everyone involved, wasn't it? It was one of those sort of...
But he was unbelievably brave. He was worthy of it in his own right. Five VCs. Yeah. It's a single unit action which got the most VCs at any point in the entire Second World War.
So this email comes from Zaki Beatty McKerrow, great-grandson of Stephen Beatty, with input from Anna Beatty, granddaughter, and also the Lieutenant Commander's son, Nick Beatty. My great-grandfather, Lieutenant Commander Stephen Haldon Beatty, was the commander of the HMS Campbelltown, the destroyer which famously rammed into the Normandy dry dock in Saint-Nazaire in March 1942 during Operation Chariot. The aim of the raid was to destroy the dock, which was the only one capable of facilitating the Tirpitz on the French Atlantic coast, and thus prevent the Germans deploying Tirpitz to the Atlantic. At the time, there was great fear within the Admiralty that Tirpitz, currently docked in Trondheim, could potentially break out into the Atlantic, just as her sister ship Bismarck had done the previous year when she sank HMS Hood, the pride of the Royal Navy. The Bismarck had distracted the attention of much of the home fleet. Six battleships, two carriers, 13 cruisers and 21 destroyers were committed to hunting Bismarck for the best part of a week. 1,100 ships were lost in the Atlantic that year. The very real fear was that Tirpitz in the Atlantic would significantly raise this total. So, was the raid effective? Well, in terms of its objective, unquestionably yes. The dock was completely obliterated. It did knock out the possibility of Tirpitz venturing into the Atlantic. With the benefit of hindsight, however, we know that in fact Hitler had deemed Tirpitz too valuable to operate in the Atlantic, and with the well-known fuel issues Germany faced throughout the war, they were unwilling to send a warship requiring so much fuel or on so risky a mission. However, the Admiralty were not aware of the German position, and so their concerns were understandable. There were less tangible results too. Despite the devastation wrought upon the small town of San Jose in the course of the raid, when the surviving veterans returned to the town in 46-47, the French premier told them, "You were the first to give us hope." And to this day, the townspeople thank the families of all those involved on the anniversary of the raid every year. The spectacular and audacious nature of the raid helped the British cause with the Americans too. At this point of the war, the Yanks were unimpressed with Allied efforts. This was a major and completely unanticipated hit, and as such a PR success, some good news at last. The main strategic negative of the raid was that it led to increased focus on the Atlantic Wall due to this breach in their defences, arguably leading to a better defended Normandy for the D-Day landings. And the human cost was high. 169 lives were lost that night. 215 men were captured, but as high as that was, roughly two-thirds of the combined ops force, it can't have been a surprise. The raid was planned with the hope that they could get everybody home, but little exception of expectation of doing so. It was so dangerous, all the soldiers were offered a choice of whether to go or not, though not the sailors! Exclamation mark. Yes, this is from someone who's a naval relative. The crazy plan was simple, if full of flaws, to sail a fleet of ships, including Campbelltown, and 18 motor launches 6 miles up the Loire, under the noses of the Germans, to evade detection long enough to get Campbelltown there in one piece, ram the dock with enough speed and precision to breach the dock gate, to land all the soldiers, and for them to rendezvous with the motor launches, whose remit was to pick everyone up, sail the 6 miles back out to sea, and that's home. The chances of success were not high. In fact, Campbelltown didn't explode at 0430 as planned, but at noon the next day, when the Germans were swarming all over, and just as my great-grandfather Beatty was being interrogated by the local German garrison commander about the reasons for the ramming, which caused minimal damage to the dock gate, the 4.5 tons of Amatol explosives packed into the Campbelltown's hull blew up. God, I imagine. Yeah. That would have rattled the crockery, crikey.
The dry dock
was wrecked. 360 German troops, including 40 senior officers and civilians who were touring the ship, were killed, and the glass from the window in the interrogation room shattered all over the floor. The Normandy dry dock was out of action for the rest of the war. The raid is famous for the widespread bravery that took place. 89 members of the raiding party were awarded decorations, including 5 VCs. My great-grandfather found out that he'd been awarded a Victoria Cross only when the commander of his prisoner of war camp called a special parade, announced to the camp that Lieutenant Commander Beatty had been given a VC, read the citation. His VC was in recognition of his bravery under heavy fire from many gun emplacements surrounding the Loire estuary, and also to the crew of the Campbelltown, and saluted him. Each year, commemoration of the raid is held at Saint-Nazaire by the Saint-Nazaire Society, of which my grandfather Nick Beatty is the president. I attended the commemoration a few years ago, which was an absolute honour, so shout out to them too. Thanks to Zaki, Anna and Nick for that brilliant account.
I love it. I love that story. I love the whole story. I mean,
the whole it is absolutely breathtaking.
It really is. And there's some other stuff that I think is worth saying. So the big thing is that Saint-Nazaire is not on the Atlantic coast. It's a number of miles inland. And so they were thinking, how do we do this? So the idea was to disguise the Campbelltown as a German ship. So they changed the funnels, put up German flags, all the rest of it. Yeah. And they were also going to go, all the motorcrafts that were going to go with them were not going to go down the river. They were going to go on the mud over the mud flats, which was a part of a particularly high spring tide at that time, which meant they could go across them. So they did. So they weren't under the normal, down the normal kind of river channels. And everything seemed to be absolutely fine. But what happened was the RAF came over and bombed Saint-Nazaire that night. And the whole idea was try and kind of distract them. But in actual fact, what happened was they then kind of sort of hovered around not dropping anything. And so the commandant...
Yes, they were told to drop bomb one at a time, weren't they, to sort of create this kind of confusion.
And so the commandant in Saint-Nazaire thought, that's a bit, you know, I smell a rat here. So realised that they were doing it as a kind of, you know, as a kind of feint, effectively, a distraction. So then switched on all the, you know, ordered the guys on the flak batteries to switch on their searchlights and, of course, lit up the Campbelltown immediately. So they still had several miles to go when they were under full attack. And, you know, a lot of the casualties took, a lot of the guys that were wounded and killed were killed on that run-in before they actually got to got to Saint-Nazaire itself. They were being absolutely pummeled. So much so they thought, oh, sod this. Let's get rid of the German flags and put up our own ensign instead, which they did.
Amazing.
But they rammed it all absolutely perfectly. I think they were kind of 4 minutes late or something onto when they were scheduled to be there. And then there was this huge ding-dong, because once they've done what they're supposed to do, they've then got to sort of go into Saint-Nazaire, cause havoc, and get the hell out of there again. Some by boat, but they got shot up and sunk. Others by kind of by foot, but most of them were, a lot of them were captured. I mean, some did get away, but a lot of them were captured. But, you know, he's right about the delayed action. It didn't happen. The explosives didn't blow up till later on that day when they were all being interrogated. And of course, they were all really down in the dumps because they thought, well, it was great that we got it to the dot, but we haven't actually fulfilled the mission. They're all being interrogated. And two of the guys are being interrogated are by Paul Schmidt, who is Hitler's personal translator.
Wow.
Interrogating Mickey Byrne, who's one of the troop leaders in Two Commando. The Germans, and Schmidt says to him, you know, how on earth could you expect to win the war when, you know, U-boats are marauding over half the seas and the Japanese are over the other? And the sergeant turns to him and goes, they might have control of the seas, but only at the bottom. It's absolutely brilliant. And Mickey Byrne is another of those ones who's, when he's captured, he's photos taken of him flicking V's.
God bless him.
It's absolutely brilliant. But, the commandos, they go, there's 265 commandos.
Yeah, but don't forget, James. Don't forget, man for man, the German soldier's better.
Oh, my God. I mean, they were absolutely awesome on that raid. So what the kind of on the was it worth it question, it's a really interesting one. So, yes, they were really short of fuel, and operating those huge, great battleships is obviously incredibly costly in terms of fuel. But just because at the time they weren't planning to use it doesn't mean say they weren't ever going to use it, because Hitler's famous for changing his mind. He changes his mind all the time.
Yeah.
And if that's all they've got, and it's worth a punt, I mean, you know, a battleship and some destroyers and a light cruiser going out into the Atlantic, if they get through the screen, they're going to cause mayhem.
You know, the before the First World War, there's always this thing before and during the First World War, there's always this thing where the Navy, they don't want to fight the Germans this year. It's like, you know, there's always this thing of, can we just put off this encounter because we've got such a big, lovely, shiny fleet, we don't want to risk it, right? The Bismarck had distracted the attention of much of the home fleet.
Yep.
6 battleships, 2 carriers, 13 cruisers, 21 destroyers. Now, who is winning that naval war? Whether the Bismarck's at the top or the bottom of the ocean, 6 battleships, 2 carriers, 13 cruisers, 21 destroyers committed to dealing with that one ship. When you look at it in those terms, you know, whatever happens to the dry dock for the Tirpitz or whatever, or the Bismarck, it's kind of... It's clearly only a matter of time.
Well, I think I can see that in the beginning of 1942, you know,
but it's belt and braces, isn't it? You're doing everything you can to deny the enemy opportunity.
Exactly that. So this takes place on the night of the 26th, 27th of March, 1942. So at that stage, we're kind of getting we're in the second happy time off the East Coast. So the U-boats are causing havoc, but we can see a way forward to winning the Battle of the Atlantic. You know, the quality of U-boat crews is going down. Our technology is gaining ground. You know, the mid-Atlantic point where there's no air umbrella is getting less and less and soon to be snuffed out by the end of the war and by the end of the year. And obviously the following, you know, 14 months later, the Battle of the Atlantic is won. But in 1942, still, you know, still an awful lot to do. And you can't properly plan if you don't know how much shipping's coming across the Atlantic.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the key thing. And I would say that the risk of the Tirpitz coming out, fuel shortages aside, is worth the effort to go and do a high risk strategy like that, a high risk plan like that. And the bottom line is the largest dry dock in Europe at the time. It's 500 yards long. It was built specifically to house and treat the Normandy, you know, the great transatlantic liner. And it is out of action for the rest of the war after this raid. Whether they would use it or not is neither here nor there. The bottom line is they definitely aren't going to use it after that because it is smashed. It is out of action. And I would say that 169 dead for an operation of that scale and size and magnitude is actually, in the scheme of things, comparatively small.
How many men were lost on the Hood?
Yeah, 900 and something.
Well, there you go. So let's say the Tirpitz gets out, sinks another ship like the Hood. Then there's your balance. You're a bit credit big time. I mean, it's interesting, of course. One of the reasons the Bismarck does get into trouble, isn't it? It's because it doesn't refuel when it goes in at Brest Harbour. And the Navy, the Royal Navy had this thing, whenever you're in port, you refuel, regardless, whenever. And the Kriegsmarine don't have that because obviously they're worried about, they're watching their fuel.
Yeah.
So the knock-ons there. But I mean, yes, I mean, if you look at, if you see it simply in those terms, how many people died on the Hood, how many people died in this raid, that it explains itself. And also, you've got, again, you've got one of these special forces outfits, commandos, burning a hole in your pocket, highly trained, highly motivated people. You've got this idea of raiding culture. You've also got precedent from the Zeebrugge raid, where harbours are rammed and ships are detonated in the harbour from the First World War.
So, exactly.
So this is sort of another way of looking at it. This is business as usual. This is how the Navy... What the Navy does is it closes down the enemy's opportunities, and you know
completely. And also, you've got to remember that it's a combined operations raid. That's what combined operations are. It's how you utilise your naval forces with specialist ground forces, and that's what they're doing. And as you say, it's a bit like deploying the airborne troops later on in the war. I mean, you know, you trained them; they're there. They're all volunteers. I mean, no one asked them to become a commando. They're all doing it because they've chosen to be there. This is what they're for. And, you know, just before, you've got the Brunevel raid in February 1942.
Yep.
Before that, you've got the Vargso raid. You know, these are all successful operations. They're attacking the Reich, or, you know, the occupied territories of the Third Reich all over the place. And you also can't underestimate the kind of psychological advantage of a raid such as the Saint-Nazaire raid has on the Germans, and what that does, and how much it pisses them off, how much damage it causes, and what a slight it is and affront it is to everything that they stand for and they mean to demonstrate, etc., etc. So,
well, especially as they're giving off this, their image projection, their propaganda is all about invincibility. And anyway, we need to take we need to take a very quick break. We'll be back in a second. Time it takes to eat two chocolate biscuits and make a cup of tea.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, "Senator," I said, "you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school?" Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, "I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii." Okay. And I looked at him. I said, "You're done." I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. We've got a lot going on, so a few parish notices for you. Firstly, thanks to all of you for the positive responses to our interview with Philippe Sands. The good news is we spent 2 hours chatting with Philippe, and there's a part two coming away on Thursday, in which we really get into the details of his story about the rat line. Otto Wächter, his wife Charlotte, and son Horst all to the fore in that one. It's equally fascinating. Do not miss it. My mum today said, "Oh, that Philippe Sands We Have Ways. It's very good." I didn't know she listened to the podcast, so we flushed her out. So
she's given in. I've had some really funny comments about the pod this week. So I've been talking to an amazing guy who's stonemason called Andrew Zeminski, who's written the most fantastic book about. It's sort of a personal history of stonemasonry, but it goes all the way from kind of, you know, West Kennet Long Barrow to Stonehenge and Avebury through to Salisbury Cathedral to the influence of Moors on church architecture and all the way through. I mean, it's just really, really interesting. And he sent me an email that said, I've been really enjoying the pod. And he said, obviously, you know, I won't mention a certain American general in the airborne division. And so that was really nice. And then I got a note from the head of Wiltshire Cricket the other day about kind of whether we're allowed to use nets or not. And he said, oh, and by the way, you know, enjoying listening to the podcast on, you know, Journey to Work and stuff. So it's really nice to hear that it's sort of the net is widening.
It's getting out. It is nice, isn't it?
And now Mrs. People... Murray.
Yeah. And now Mum has succumbed. God bless her. I thought the things, both of those podcasts with Philippe were fascinating, and I'm still, you know, that you have such a contrast between Otto, between Horst, you know,
and
Nicholas Frank. It's just it's extraordinary, and also that thing we talked about how Nicholas Frank was basically the first of the Brass's children to go, I don't, you know, to break cover and say something. It's absolutely.
We should get him on. He's such a nice guy, Nicholas.
So on Thursday night, we will be live streaming again at 8:30 PM UK time. There are now 1,100 members of the independent company.
But verging onto it. Next stop is a brigade, isn't it?
Well, I think. We could call ourselves a regiment now, couldn't we? And there are free audio books, daily discussions and debates, plus a live TV version of the show every Thursday night.
I'm getting lots more material on. Sherwood Rangers, by the way, coming out. A whole load of stuff came in today, stuff that I've never seen before. So brilliant, absolutely
excellent.
Brilliant.
So that's Thursday is the live stream. From Wednesday, May the 26th, 80 years on from the most important week in British history.
Well, no, I'll just contextualise this. Okay, so I was doing a talk about Dunkirk. I was getting really carried away about it, and I was just thinking about this. You know, I was just telling them what happened, this incredible drama that took place. You know, it's not just the rescuing of the BEF; it's this huge political machinations that are going on between Halifax and Churchill and Chamberlain, and so on.
Yeah,
you know, the stakes couldn't possibly be higher. And at the end of it, I just thought, I literally cannot think of a more important week in British history ever, where so much happened that could have potentially imperiled our entire nation in such a dramatic way. So I suddenly stood up on stage and said, and to my mind, it was the most important week ever in British history. And I sort of, the more I thought about it, the more I kind of think it probably was. So anyway, so we're going to do all that stuff.
Well, no, I mean, I think one of the really interesting things about Dunkirk is very often in history, you have things where there's like, where you really can't say that individuals are making decisions that actually pivotally change everything. You really can't say that about a lot of historical events. And you know, that's one of the things we accept now about history, that very often there are, you know, that things grind along in the way they do, like tectonic plates. But this period of history, there are some people who make individual decisions that are massively, massively important. And they make those decisions constrained within the constraints of their circumstance, yes, but also because that's the decision they make, because that's what they're like, you know, or that's the conclusion they arrive at. And you really, really do, I think, genuinely, and it's rare enough in history, this, actually, that there's a moment where what someone decides is the thing that influences everything. I mean, you know, just before the 26th, of course, is the halt order. And you burrow into the history, you know, you've got the close up order before it and then the halt order itself. And you burrow into the history of that and actually look at who's saying what to who and then what they're writing their diary afterwards and all that. And there is one person who makes that decision. And that is before the most important, it sets up the most important week in British history.
Yeah.
So it's probably the most important decision in the last 100 years of history, full stop.
Yes.
I would have thought.
Yeah, I think you could certainly argue and argue convincingly that.
Because on the Patreon, we discussed what if the halt order isn't given, you know, and the Patreon's amazing, the independent company arguing about this. No halt order, what happens? And we said, well, it then sort of devolves into a political decision rather than anything you can do strategically. You know, the strategic will, you know, because actually there are four levels. There's the tactical, operational, strategic, and then the political that hovers above all of them. None of them all happen without, they all interrelate, obviously. I mean, we'll talk about this, but obviously the halt order's because you've got half the German army brass are it, or well, not even half, a section of them are into this blitzkrieg, no flanks, punch through, Klotzen nicht kleben, just get on with
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Just get through at all costs, doesn't matter. And then the rest of them are going, fuck, our flanks are exposed. Yeah, yeah, yeah. My infantry aren't up yet. Oh, mm-hmm. God. And so you have, I mean, and von Rundstedt starts to panic. And of course, he's always held up as he's held up as the best of the best of the German generals.
Well, he's held up as a sort of steady ship, isn't he? And this is what's so interesting on both sides, whether German or British. It's the guys who are normally level-headed and clear-thinking and, you know, known for their good judgment that are kind of found wanting.
Yeah, and he goes, oh, I'm not sure about this, so slow stuff down. And then Hitler goes, well, if von Rundstedt's nervous about it, I'm going to, all right, stop. And you know, to go back to my original point, this is one of those moments where one person's individual, their decision, you know, and we are then in the realms of the sort of the absolute lightning in the bottle, phantom stuff of history. It's someone's personality, which takes you away from the idea of the impersonal forces of history and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't you think? And then and then we get into Churchill in the garden at Downing Street with Halifax. Oh my God! Churchill said to Halifax. I mean, maybe it's I've
thank
got
God
pictures
he said
of
it.
You with a lap. Well, exactly. But what was it? I've got pictures of you with that Labrador. We don't know, do we? Because then you're into the political world where it's the dark arts of politics, where how people exert personal pressure on each other. Were he not in the Lords, would have been Prime Minister, blah, blah, blah.
But just think about what's... Okay, so we're going to start on the 26th of May, because back in 1940, that was a Sunday. That was a national day of prayer in Britain led by the king. Okay, you know, we're so up the creek that the only thing left to us is to pray. I mean, that is basically what that is saying. That is how dire the situation is. And yet, a week later, fast forward that to the 3rd of June, we're out of the woods. It's amazing. Well, it's absolutely amazing. So what we're going to do is over that week, I think every day we'll talk through the day's events 80 years ago. We'll discuss that. Yep. We're going to have guests on, aren't we? Including Ingram.
Ingram, my father is going to join us. Because
we're going to talk to Steve Prince, who's the head of the Naval Historical Branch, who is just amazing. God, he's so brilliant on all this stuff. The strategic earthquake is what he calls it. And we'll have guests on, and we'll do a little special. It'll be on the cut of the main pod, won't it? Every single day. Be great.
The thing we're going to talk about with Ingram, with my dad, is he researched what happened to... My mother's father was in the Bucks Battalion, who were territorial battalion from Marlow in Buckinghamshire, light infantry. He was the adjutant, and they ended up in a place called Hazebrook, which is down the road from Cassel.
Yes.
And Cassel's this plug of hill in Flanders with a windmill on the top. That's a really striking... Really striking town that you can see from all around.
And a statue and of Marshal down... Foch.
That's right, yeah. And a plaque for the Gloucesters. And down the hill from there is Hazebrook, where the Bucks Battalion ended up. And 10 years or so ago, my father, maybe even a little bit longer than that, maybe 12 years ago, my father was instrumental in having a plaque put up at the place that was the orphanage where the Bucks Battalion headquarters made its last stand.
Great.
And I've got, you know, a load of photos from the unveiling, which I think we'll talk a little bit about this on Thursday for the live cast. I'll show you some of the pictures. Dad delved right into what happened to the Bucks Battalion, to this TA Battalion, and the sort of because they went up to the deal line, then back, you know, they did the whole yo-yo, but it's their stand there. And the Royal Horse Artillery, who are also involved, and all these sort of, and the sappers who all had to, as he put it, ditch their shovels and get out their rifles. You know, all the sort of, all the stuff that happens around the Bucks Battalion. And that's that's just before, I think it's the 25th that reaches its climax. So we'll be talking about that with Ingram, and hopefully he's getting pretty deaf now. Hopefully he'll hear all our questions, but he'll probably be happy if we don't butt in. if I'm honest with you,
it'll be great.
No, I'm really looking forward to that. And then, and Robin Schaefer as well, who is going to bring us some German stuff. He's got correspondence from German soldiers, so we'll hear what the other side thought of what was going on. Which
the
I think
other side of the hill. Yep.
The other side of the hill, which is really fantastic. A beauty of having a community of listeners is all the interaction and tangents we get led down. No sooner had we received the question about Saint-Nazaire from Colin Houston when we received a DM on Twitter from another listener, Magnus, with this intriguing question. Hi, great show and all that. You are both fantastic, well done, etc., etc. I like this guy. I've been reading Battle of the Atlantic, something new to learn about. I went down a Google wormhole when I read that after D-Day, Brestport held out until September 44, and Saint-Nazaire and other Breton ports didn't surrender until after VE Day, despite France being liberated well before then. I understand that Eich bypassed them for a reason, invade Germany himself, but surely the Free French couldn't have been happy about the Germans still being there. Also, it wouldn't have taken all of the Allied army to take them. Were there battles, and did they just hold out? Was it all just sealed off? Was it the whole town or just the docks? Reading about Saint-Nazaire, then I found about US Airman Alan McGee, which blew my mind. Assume this is true. Well, the thing is, you had German Festungs, didn't you? So that Hitler's whole thing was that he wasn't going to surrender ports. And preparation went into that very early on, as soon as the invasion began. Proper problem for the Allied effort. But it was
another byproduct of the raid on Saint-Nazaire was that it got massively reinforced.
But you end up with, you know, all of these, basically, Calais and all these places being invested and then left to it. Really, there's no point fighting it out over these ports.
Well, the Canadians get Calais and Dunkirk and Gravelines and all those places. Yeah, so they capture those before they go into the Scheldt campaign. But the ones in Britain, they're a complete waste of time. I mean, why would we want to waste any ordnance on that? I mean, we're not going to need them. We're never going to need them. Total waste of time. So they just said, okay, fine. Yeah. Stay there then.
Because after all, Cherbourg, they destroyed the dock, didn't they? So there's the thing. Even if we do take a place like this, they're going to destroy the harbour.
Well, and
so
also we've now got loads of beaches, and we've got a Mulberry Harbour, and that's doing it just fine. Yeah. Thank you very much. Yeah. You haven't got to go down the Cotentin Peninsula. Yeah. I mean, it was just absolutely no point in taking all those places. So yeah, they did. They just left them there.
You're trying to go the most direct route to Germany, after all, and Saint-Nazaire isn't the most direct route.
Saint-Nazaire and Brittany is within the American bit, and the Americans are just all their interest in a straight line to Berlin. I mean, you know, that's the strategy.
Yeah. Now the second thing mentioned by Magnus was the cryptic reference to Alan McGee. Now this is amazing. This Alan McGee was an American ball turret gunner on a B-17. January 3rd, 43, he was on a bombing run over Saint-Nazaire. He left his turret when it was damaged by flak and found his parachute was torn and useless. More flak blew off a section of the right wing and McGee was thrown clear of the aircraft. He fell over 20,000 feet before crashing through the glass roof of the Saint-Nazaire train station. Rescuers found him on the floor of the station. McGee was treated by the Germans, 28 shrapnel wounds, several broken bones, damage to his nose, eye, lung and kidney. His right arm was nearly severed. McGee was liberated in May 1940 from a POW camp and received the Air Medal for his meritorious conduct and the Purple Heart. He then lived to the age of 84 and died in 2003. I mean, oh Christ. I mean... Well,
I know a guy who parachuted. It was in the army. He was in the Irish Guards, and he jumped out of a plane. His parachute didn't open, and he landed on a corrugated roof in.
Yes, yes, I remember reading about that.
Charlie, yeah, and he survived. Yeah. He had nothing more than a broken finger, little finger.
And there's the guy who jumped out of a Lancaster, isn't there? Fell out of a Lancaster and without a chute, and did the same kind of altitude and slid down some trees and landed in a snowdrift. Something.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it can happen, but you've got the luck of the devil if you survive a parachute drop without a parachute.
Well, I think we've done our time. Keep the correspondence coming in. We love getting your stories. They're a real treasure trove. A Trevor trove is something else. That's a place full of Trevors. Remember, where do they make Trevors in a Trevor trove? Remember, part two, Philippe Sands is on Thursday. It's the Rat Line and
really Philippe good stuff.
Is hinting. Yeah, and he tells us where that's taking him next, where the rat line is leading him to,
yes,
which is fascinating. A live stream on Thursday night. 495 of you joined us last Thursday, and it was a lot of fun. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Cheerio.
Yeah, cheerio.